Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and we've got our usual co-host, Jazz, with us, plus another special guest in-house today. We've got Richard Hodges from Bellridge Projects. And as far as I can see, that he specializes in small residential developments, including land subdivisions, investor and joint venture opportunities. Welcome on board, Richard.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Good to have you on. I mean, we always, Jazz and I always wanted to get a developer on board. And I think, you know, this is our opportunity to be able to talk about some exciting stuff, especially when we can look at residential developments, because that's one of the areas that, I mean, I personally haven't got too much experience in. I know about Jazz, I think, but certainly we're very excited to have someone on board that can share your experience. But just first and foremost, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you're doing now, and maybe something that people don't know about you?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, I started Bellridge Projects about 2.5 years ago. Well, 2.5 years ago, I got my first deal. So I started it a bit before that while I was looking for my first deal. But previous to that, I've done a few different things. Most of it has been sales related. So I've been account management, sales, real estate sales. I had an eBay business at one stage in the late 2000s. Done bits and pieces, but I've always had a passion for property and always wanted to get into property, particularly in the small development space. So I took that plunge 2.5 years ago, and here I am now.
Well, you definitely are in the right space, in the right area, it looks like, Richard. A lot of activity happening down that way in the north side of the Brisbane. So, yes. And that's where you are based, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. More specifically, my projects are centred around the Moreton Bay region at this stage. Not to say that I don't look elsewhere. It just seems to be that's where I my expertise lies, and that's where I end up picking up my deals.
Right. Now, that's great. So, Richard, tell us a little bit. Obviously, you said that you started on this journey 2.5 years ago because you had this passion of doing some developments in the real estate space, right? So where did it got started from is what I'm trying to understand. Basically, the very first deal that you made, maybe if you can give us a little bit of insight into how you managed to fund the property, how did you go with the development? Because you obviously didn't have experience at that time.
No.
This can be a little bit tricky when you don't have any experience in that space, because obviously you're dealing with challenges of money, finance, and then counsel, and then finding that kind of side where something can be done, and hopefully there's money to be made at the end. So give us a little bit more insight into how this got started, and maybe a bit more into your first project.
Yeah, sure. Yep. So like I said, I've always had that passion for property, but you know, like a lot of people, just held myself back from actually taking that plunge. So I was in a particular job that I didn't particularly like. Like a lot of us, you just turn up every day and do your hours and go home. So that created enough pain, I guess, for me to actually, you know, set a plan in place to actually get out and do what I wanted to do. So I saved up some money and created a bit of equity in an investment property that we had, drawed out of that, and then gave myself a particular amount of time to live off that equity to make things happen. So, but previous to that, I got a lot of education. So I did a lot of mentoring, went to seminars, courses, that type of thing, and really educated myself in that space as much as possible. So at the end of 2016, I think it was November 2016, I decided to just leave full-time work altogether and just go all in, basically. I didn't have any deals. Obviously, without a job, I wouldn't be able to get finance. So, I mean, I had pretty much everything stacking up against me. But I did have a fair bit of education. I built a good network of other developers that could act as mentors for me. You know, started building up my team, all that type of thing. So ticked a lot of those boxes, but just needed the time to execute. So I took that plunge, and within a month, 2 months, I picked up my first deal. And that was through letters. So I send out targeted letters to properties that I'm interested in. And and feel the responses and then make offers directly to owners. So in this particular case, it was a owner that responded to one of my letters. We started discussing the property. I made an offer. He didn't accept, and then toed and froed a little bit and didn't accept, and then decided not to sell. Then, long story short, about a month later, he contacted me and said, look, we are ready to sell. Let's talk again. So we did and came to an agreement. And, yeah, that was my first deal. So I got that under contract early 2017. It was actually just straight after New Year's Day 2017. So solicitors weren't open, anything like that. So I had to try and tie him over until I could get contracts prepared and what have you. So I got that under contract and then went about doing my due diligence, but at the same time finding a JV partner to fund the deal. Because as I said, I didn't have a job at the time, so I didn't have any way of funding it. Put it out there to the networks that I'm a part of, and was able to find a couple of potential JV partners that wanted to JV. We discussed it. One of them, you know, we got on really well. We decided to JV. He took a punt on me, obviously being my first deal, without the actual experience. I have to take my hat off to Josh, who was my first JV partner. He had to take a bit of a punt on me. But the thing was, the deal worked. And that's the main thing. You know, if the deal works, then you're halfway there. So, yeah, how the first deal was born, basically.
Yep. So just quickly on that. So you left your job. You didn't have money. You found the joint venture partner, right? Yes. Before that, you already had signed the contract for the deal, correct? Before finding the partner. So if you were not able to, for whatever reason, find the partner, I'm assuming there was a finance clause in there that you were going to pull out within the 14 days, or how did you?
Due diligence. So I had a 30-day due diligence clause.
Right.
So as long as... Yeah, so there's no way. I mean, I paid $1,000 holding, you know, a refundable $1,000 holding deposit. And worst case scenario, if I couldn't make it happen within 30 days, I could get out of the contract and have my $1,000 refunded. So
what was part of your due diligence? I mean, one was obviously trying to find that money partner within 30 days, I'm guessing. Also trying to work out if council is going to let it subdivide or not.
Yes. So it was a 1,000 square meter block, and the intention was to split it into two blocks, the two 500 square meter lots. So one of my main due diligence tasks was to get in contact with council, and that was via my town planner, and we requested pre-lodgement advice. So rather than have an actual pre-lodgement meeting, we just requested written advice from the council. That came within two and a half weeks. And that pretty much gave us a good idea that of what we could do with the block. It's not obviously not a full approval, but it just gives us the council's stance and their opinion and whether they'll support that type of development on that particular block.
So it's called a pre-lodgement advice. Is that what it's called?
Pre-lodgement advice, yes.
And how much did that cost you, just out of curiosity?
Good thing is Moreton Bay Council offer free pre-lodgement advice and also free pre-lodgement meetings. So you could actually go in and have meetings with the council for free as well to talk about particular developments. So I've done that since then as well. So that's one of the good things about Moreton Bay. I know there are other councils like Brisbane, for example. I think they charge $500 per meeting. So it's a good service that they offer.
And whereabouts was this site again?
Scarborough. So it's on the Redcliffe, the Redcliffe Peninsula, north of Brisbane.
Yep.
Yeah, on the bay.
So within those 30 days, you were able to find the joint venture.
Yep.
And you were able to get this pre-assessment from the council that, there is a good possibility this block can be subdivided without spending any money on it at this point.
That's right, yes. So... At that stage, I didn't have to spend any money. There were some issues with the sewer line running through the block. So we had to do some assessments with that and some discussions with our civil engineer and Unity Water, who are the water authority in this particular area, to find out what implications that would have. From memory, there was a little bit of cost there, but from what I remember, it might have been a few hundred dollars.
Very keen to know, set the joint venture up in this case, because obviously it was a new party. This is not someone known to you. It's not your family member or anything. So there's risk, a lot of risk mitigation required, right? So
that's
from,
right.
From the structure setup perspective, how did you guys went into the that side of it? So to be able to get some lending, or was that joint venture partner funding 100% of the deal?
Yeah, so basically, my joint venture partner for that deal was someone I'd only met once, very briefly, at a network meeting. And we expressed, you know, I expressed that I'm looking for a deal, looking to get into my first project, and we'll be needing a joint venture partner. And he expressed that he wants to become a joint venture partner and invest in someone else's deal. So once I got one, we got in touch. So the mechanics of it was that I purchased the property in a shelf company. So I established a company before starting to search for deals that I was making offers. I was making offers within that company. And then once I found the joint venture partner, we actually transferred directorship over to him so that he could get the finance and obviously, have security, his security could be the property. And then I sat outside that company. I sat outside that company, but we established a joint venture agreement. And that's what, that's how the joint venture partnership was born, I guess. So at the end of the day, he needed to get finance. Therefore, he needed to be technically the owner of the property. And then I sat outside that as a development manager and joint venture partner.
You being the joint venture partner, but were not actually the part of the company, which means the property was not under your names. That was the property was solely, yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, not this particular one. So so basically, the way it was structured is that I had control over, so I had power of attorney over the company and the property. And so basically I had control over the property without actually having to own it in the end. Yeah.
Right. And what does that power of control or the power of attorney allowed you to do?
So it allows me to sign anything basically to do with that property. Obviously, within our JV agreement, all major decisions are done mutually. But it just to speed up processes and not have to, it's a way to not have to be chasing my JV partner to right. sign documents and what have you. I can make a phone call. We can come to an agreement, and then I can go ahead and make the calls and the decisions and sign. So it's more of an efficiency thing, I guess. But yeah, that's how we ended up structuring that, because obviously if I was in that particular one, if I was continued being part of the company or even a shareholder of the company, then I would have to be reviewed from a finance perspective. And it probably would have hurt the deal at that stage.
Right.
Yeah.
And the actual joint venture agreement that you guys had separately, was that more of a legal document or more of a handshake agreement?
Full legal document. It's about 35 pages long, I think. And it covers everything. It covers all different scenarios of what could happen. It's very important, particularly, I mean, I was going to say particularly if you don't know the person well, but I'd even recommend it for family and friends and what have you, because you just never know what could happen within that time. So it's imperative that you have everything in writing and you cover all potential scenarios and what, you know, the plan of action would be if that scenario was, eventuated. At the end of the day, you know, and like with all my JVs at this time, we sign the contract at the beginning, and then they're pretty much put in the drawer, and you hardly ever look at them again. You know, they'll only ever come out if there's any issues or anything like that. But it is very important that everything is written in a legal document at the beginning. Basically, the main thing is so everybody knows where they stand and what their role is within the partnership.
I mean, that's another challenge of preparing this joint venture agreement legal yes. document. So you already knew someone within your network of people who were lawyers and all who actually helped you prepare this document, or how did you go about starting on this one?
Yeah, so I was given a template basically to start with, but we had to appoint my solicitor to actually build upon that and create a document, you know, for our particular situation. So I did start with a template, but there was a fair bit of work that went into it. So there was some work and cost into creating that that document. But the good thing about it is that I can continue using it now for new joint venture arrangements and just change certain things within the document that are particular to that particular arrangement at that particular time.
Right. Okay. So that's very interesting. So by this time, so 30 days contract clause has obviously expired. You guys had this joint venture agreement in place before the clause expired, the 30-day finance clause and the due diligence. Yep. And you guys had the lending solid, which is the joint venture partner took out the loan in their name. To give us a bit more details on the project now, what actually happened with the project after that?
Yeah, so we settled about, I think it was about 3 months after we went under contract. So within that time, in my purchase contract, I have a set of special conditions that allows me to obviously do the due diligence, but it also allows me to submit the council application, so the subdivision application. So that way, if I've got a 3 month settlement, for example, I can get a head start on the development itself. So if I remember correctly, by the time we settled, we actually had, I think it was 2 weeks after we settled, we actually had the development approval. So that helps with saving and holding costs and what have you. And yeah, within 2 weeks after settlement, we had started demolishing and going through the whole process. So the council set a certain number of conditions on the development that you've got to meet, so that once you've met those conditions, you go back to council and go for plan sealing.
Right. Okay. So normally the advice from conveyancers is, or the solicitor is, to not do anything with the property or the council side until the property is settled, just purely because in case the settlement, something goes wrong with the settlement, not necessarily from the buyer side, but more from the seller side as well. So you guys basically still decided to go ahead within that time while in that 3 month settlement period to get all the plans and approvals in place for the demolition of the building and the subdivision, essentially.
Yes, that's right. I guess you've got to weigh up the probability. You know, what are the probabilities that something will go wrong, and what's the benefit of getting the head start as opposed to the probability? So it always makes sense from a development standpoint. And I know even on a larger scale, talking to a lot of larger developers, they try and do the same thing, you know, an extended settlement, or they may have an option on the property, and they go about adding value to the property by getting the development application. So it does make sense from a development standpoint to try and get a head start on the development, because as we know, the thing with the development side is that in most cases you're not earning a rental income, so you really can't offset any holding costs with any income. So the more that you can get done before starting to pay holding costs, the better.
Look, I think in a sense, because what Richard was doing there is just submitting the DA and getting a pre-approval. I mean, he's not really demolishing the property at that point in time. So he's not doing any physical things to the property until after settlement. So I think that's just, you know, that's so I think that from that perspective, you know, there's no risk to the seller, and obviously just try to maximize the opportunity of these 3 months window where, you know, hey, the seller's still paying the mortgages, if there's one. He's not paying the mortgages, so might as well use this time to make sure that you push ahead with the DA. So, you know, that's a win-win for both parties as far as I can see.
The worst case scenario for us in that regard is if it doesn't settle for one reason or another, we may be out of pocket, just off the top of my head, maybe $6,000 or $7,000. On a small project like that, obviously it's larger and larger projects, but, you know, town planning fees, surveying fees, and council application fees, that type of thing. So that would have been the worst case scenario. So basically after that, we go about, so in parallel with that, so this is something we would have initiated before settlement, is that we also, so you make your application to council, but you've also got to make your application to Unity Water, who are the water authority, as mentioned earlier. So they, you need to make your application for the connection. So we had to get sewer and water connections done to the site. Or to the new block. So obviously one block will already have existing sewer and water connections that went to the existing house, and the other block would need to have them put in. So that is always a condition of council. So we preempt that and then start the process with Unity Water. Now, that is a long, drawn-out process, so the sooner you can get started, the better. So basically what we did is we had our civil engineer draw up designs for where the sewer and water would be connected. We submit them to Unity Water. They go through their processes and also grant an approval with conditions as well. So it's basically you work both of those in parallel to save time. So by the time we settled, we demolished a couple of weeks later, and I think it was about a month or two before we had the connections done. Now, we did come into a problem with this. It did have a sewer line running up the inside boundary, a main sewer, one of the inside boundaries, and Unity Water were going to make us impose a 3-metre easement on that particular pipe. Now, the issue with that is that we only have 10-metre frontage blocks, so that was going to take 3 metres out of a 10-metre frontage block. So if you can just imagine, the easement ran up the side boundary. So that was an issue that we had and a challenge that we had to overcome. Now, we did know that this was the case as a worst-case scenario during our due diligence. So we were comfortable with that, but we were also planning to dispute it or fight it in a way and try and get it reduced. So we did end up getting it reduced by a little bit, down to 2.4 metres. And so that did prolong the time it took to get the connections for that particular job.
Right, okay. And roughly how long the whole water process took after the block was the house was demolished?
I think we got them connected in about 2 months, 2 months after we demolished. Yeah.
Okay, so the land was already titled, so you had two different titles in place, or that was still a process to be done?
That's still a process. So there was a whole set of other conditions. So the sewer and water are just one set of conditions. There are other conditions like needing documentation from the telecommunications company to prove that we can connect Telstra or NBN to the block. You need paperwork or certification from Energex to prove that electricity can be connected to the block. There's other little conditions like removing the crossover and reinstating the curb and channel, and a few other little bits and pieces that also come into it as well. And a lot of it is site specific. Like, for example, we had to put street trees in. That's another little condition that they put in as well. So once all that was complete, then we go back to council with the final survey plan that I got the surveyor to do throughout that process. And then the council basically checks that we've met all those conditions. They stamp our final survey, or our survey plan, sorry, and then that's when we go to the titles office to apply for title registration. So up until that point, the new titles do not exist yet. But in saying that, we still seek contracts or sales. So throughout this process, basically what I do is straight after the house is demolished, I start marketing the blocks. Some people like to do it before, get a head start and do it before it's demolished, but being an ex-real estate agent, I understand that first impressions count, and I don't like putting it out to the market until the blocks are clear and also marked out. So I mark out the blocks so people can actually see what they're purchasing. You don't want to put it to the market and burn a lot of initial inquiry by people driving past and seeing the old fibro house out there and not being able to envision what they're purchasing. So, yeah, we actually got a sale fairly early, within 2 weeks of listing them. And basically we put together a more or less an off-the-plan style contract. Because the new titles don't exist, we've got to set up an off-the-plan contract basically, which then settles after the new titles are registered.
Sure. So how long did the whole process took end to end to get the actual titles so you can sell that off and make your profits out of it?
Yeah, sure. So let's say I went under contract early January, didn't settle till April, and we had title registration by about August that year. So right. That one, because of the delays with the sewer, that's what really it could have been done a lot quicker. So sometimes they can be done quicker. Sometimes they can drag out a bit longer. But a basic 1-2 subdivision, you usually can get them in between 6 to 9 months is usually the time frame.
Sure. And how much did the whole subdivision end up costing you out of pocket before recovering the money?
Including purchase, like including everything, or
not just the actual subdivision to get the titles, basically. Yeah. Just subdivision. Okay. So all the whole thing with the council.
Yeah, sure. So if you include everything from the demolition to all the consultants' fees, what else have we got? We've got in our particular council and in most councils, you've got to pay headworks or what they call infrastructure charges. So that's a fee to council and also to Unity Water for basically creating another lot and basically what they say is you're putting a strain because we're creating a new lot and increasing the population of the area, you're creating more of a strain on the infrastructure. So basically all developers need to contribute to an infrastructure fund to upgrade infrastructure in the future. So that there was about 28 grand that just went in that as well. So if you calculate all that, what else did we have? Sewer and water connections, all the fees associated with that. It was about 110 grand in costs.
110 grand in costs, including the demolition of the property.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Right.
And then
you say that's on the higher side, or what was your original ballpark budget for this, for the whole subdivision process?
Yeah, so usually when I budget, I include stamp duty, all the purchase costs, all that type of thing, because all that's got to be taken into account. We also pay GST as well, because we run it as a business. And the intention is to subdivide, we need to pay GST. So usually you budget roughly anywhere between 120 to 150, depending on the area and what the council requires. Like, for example, just on my latest project, since doing this one, the council, our local council has now drawn a line in the sand and is making all developers or any new lots install underground power. So on our latest project, we're needing to install underground power. And the difference in price on this particular project as opposed to what we used to only have to do, and that was just to get a certificate, is about 20 grand. So there's a big cost increase there as well, which needs to be considered, but we didn't have to worry about that in our first deal.
So basically the cost that you're budgeting for on an average for this sort of simple subdivision, which is 1-2 kind of thing, is some anywhere between 100 to 120, you said, right? Or 150?
120 to 150.
Yeah, probably 120 to 150, and that includes purchase costs, holding costs, all that type of thing. So that's what I call your back of the envelope number. So if you're wanting to, basically what I do is I try and look at as many deals as I can, and when you're assessing so many deals, you want to have a formula that you can use really quickly to eliminate any deals that just are not stacking up from day one. So you want to do them really quickly to get through as many deals as you can, because I may go through 50 plus offers before I find the right deal. So back of the envelope, you'd use a number between 120 and 150 just to see if the deal stacks up. And then if it passes that first test, then you'd start getting into the nitty-gritty of putting the costs into a feasibility and going from there.
So just to be clear on this 120 to 150 number, when you say that you include the purchase cost as well, that means all the stamp duty, conveyancer fee and all of that stuff is included in this cost, right?
Yes, that's right. And holding costs.
And holding costs.
Finance costs. So like I said, it's just a round number that is a back of the envelope style feasibility that you can do within 3 minutes, basically. Yeah.
It'd be easier if we consider from a whole holistic, from the end-to-end perspective. So how much was the purchase cost of the actual property with the land?
This particular one was 555.
So 555 plus, say, and the actual cost you said from including the subdivision plus the purchase cost, how much was that? 125 or something, or was it 130? So
all up, it was, so I've actually got my feasibility here in front of me. So it's because like I said, it was 2 years ago, so I wouldn't remember the numbers off the top of my head.
Sure.
But it was $688,000 was the total cost.
That was the total cost, okay.
Before GST.
Okay. And what was the end sales? How much profit did you make out of this deal?
So in this particular deal, my joint venture partner ended up keeping one of the blocks. So we sold one block, and then the other block that had the sewer easement running down the side did prove difficult to sell. So our backup plan was that, and this was thought up by the JV partner, is that he was going to keep the block and then build on it. So he ended up in the end deciding to do that. And what we did is just got the block valued, and then we worked out our end value based on that. So based on the sale of the first block, and then the valuer's opinion on the second block. So based on that, the total profit was $101,000 or $102,000 on that particular deal.
So if we were to do, so you said $102,000 was the profit and $668 was the total cost, including everything, subdivision and all that stuff, right?
Yes.
So that's roughly about 15% return that you ended up getting on that property.
Yes, yes.
Or on that deal, sorry, yeah.
Yes, 15%.
Right, okay. And how did you guys structure it from the profit-sharing perspective? Because you were the one who actually found the deal, and you were the one who actually did take care of the project, or so-called project manager in this case. And then you had a joint venture person who actually was putting the money in, or the money partner, let's just call it. How did you guys do the splits in that case? Is there a flat formula that you guys apply, or how did you guys basically go about it?
Yeah, so usually in that scenario, what I like to do is to, and I learned this off a mentor of mine, is just basically split the deal into four equal quarters. So basically what that is you've got the person who finds the deal is one of the quarters. The second one is the person that uses their skill and time to manage the deal. And then the third one is financing the deal, and then the fourth one is the cash or the equity required for the deal. Okay, so, and usually what I do is give them equal weighting. Now, this can be negotiated either one way or the other. This is just a basic overview. So in that particular case, I was bringing to the table two of those, and my JV partner was bringing the other two. So we would go 50-50. Now, in this particular case, being my first ever deal and having to give somebody the, entice them into, I guess, taking a punt on me with someone with really not much experience, a lot of education, but not much experience, I gave him a little bit more. So in this particular case, we structured it 60-40, so 60 going to my JV partner, and that was enough for him to, enough of a compensation, I guess, to go with somebody who at that stage had no experience. Obviously, since then, anything that is structured this way, I go 50-50. But being my first deal, I wanted to just to give them a little bit more.
Sure.
Yeah.
So with that profit of $102K, is that gross profit or is that net profit?
So that's net.
That's net. Okay. So that's after all costs and the GST, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Yes. So that's net profit. Basically, that's net profit before our own
taxes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Cool. All right. Excellent.
So that's good. So this whole deal, Richard took roughly about, we said August, it was is when it got complete. So from Jan till August. So it was an 8-month project, basically, right?
Yes. Yes.
And it being a split of block, so it was obviously easier to get divorced as well. One kept the block, the other one took the profits and walked away. So since then, so that would have been a pretty good learning exercise for you, a good learning curve, I guess. And since then, have you done any more projects within this space, or what happened next, basically?
Yeah, so actually, while not long after we settled this property in April of 2017, I purchased another property. So I had both going concurrently. The second property was up for auction, basically, and it was a three-lot property. So I was already on three lots. I'm not sure if you have this type of property in the other states, but up in Queensland, we have some properties with that may be already on two, three, sometimes four lots. And all they require is title registration to be able to split them. There's no need to go to council or anything like that. But in this particular case, this property came up in the same suburb that I was already working in and coming up for auction. I was already on three lots. So I made an offer straight after it hit the internet 4 weeks before auction, but with conditions. And the way I tried to structure this was that, look, I've got 2 weeks of conditions. Obviously, the way I tried to sell it to the agent and to the vendor was that they had a four-week campaign until auction. Just give me 2 weeks conditional, continue marketing, do whatever you need to do, and then obviously if I don't purchase the property, you've still got 2 weeks before the auction. At that stage, they didn't accept it. They just wanted cash unconditional. So I knew how good this site was. Obviously, I didn't know how much they were wanting to sell it for, but I did whatever I could to become cash unconditional by auction date. So long story short, talked to a lot of JV partners and what have you, but I just couldn't nail anyone down before auction. So I actually came to the decision that if I can get this at a particular price that I know works really, really well, then I know I'll find the money. There's this mantra that a mentor also taught me, is that if you find a good enough deal, the money will come. So that was kind of the philosophy I had going into this auction. So, yeah, here I was at this auction. I set a price on this property that I was willing to purchase at auction, knowing that I had no way of getting finance myself or any way of settling this property, but knowing that if I did have a good enough deal that I was going to find the money through money partners. So long story short, I actually did end up buying that property at auction. Luckily, I pre-negotiated a two-month settlement before the auction started, which they agreed to, and that gave me 2 months to actually find the money for this deal. So you can imagine I had a few sleepless nights within that 2 months.
That's where you truly become the professional. By doing your first deal, within the first deal, you had your confidence shot up quite a lot, where you ended up doing a thing without having your finance on it, or deal without having your finance on it.
Yeah, I mean, from the outside, it looks very risky, and I guess it is, but the thing was, I guess the way I mitigated that risk was that I was an area expert in this area, so I knew the area back to front. I knew the end sale values. I also, like I mentioned before, I do network a lot, so I've been to a lot of network meetings. So I have access. I know I have access to a lot of resources around me. It's just a matter of being able to draw on those resources when I need them. And so a lot of, although it looks risky from the outside, it wasn't as risky as it looked, because I did have those resources around me. It was just a matter of me being able to draw on them and structure it in a way to make the deal work, basically.
That's all very interesting. And I think, you know, Richard, I think that's excellent. And we could be talking this for days. I mean, it's so interesting, exciting, but I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up due to time constraints. What would be your three biggest tips for someone who's going to start out and looking at doing these kind of small subdivision projects? What would be your three biggest tips for them?
Yeah, sure. So number one is get educated. Find a mentor or a group of mentors and do the courses. Obviously, be selective. Get some referrals, references, that type of thing of the courses that you're looking at. But definitely get out there and learn. Network would be my number two. Get amongst others that are doing what you're wanting to do. You know, they do say we've all heard it before, you're the average of the five people you hang around. You know, I never had anyone in my personal life that does what I do, so I had to actually go out and seek them, and that's why I'm a big believer in network meetings and just getting around those people. Yeah, definitely one and two is get educated. Number three is take the plunge. Like we talked about before, you know, I know in Queensland, speaking for Queensland, you can get a property under contract and as long as you've got an out clause, whether it's finance, due diligence, you know, due diligence is probably the best one, but as long as you've got an out clause, if all else fails, you can get out without any penalty. And I can tell you now, within that 30 days or 14 days of due diligence that you've got that property in, you'll learn more than you've ever learned before in a deal. Like, for example, like I said, I have done the courses, I've done what have you, but in that 30 days of due diligence on my first deal, I learned more in that 30 days than I had learned in the 3 years previous to that. So the trick is
by actually doing it, isn't it?
Exactly. The trick is you just got to take that action and just do it. But also have an out that that if, you know, if it doesn't go to plan, you can get
things
out.
Things do go south. Yeah. Yeah. That's very important.
Don't go out and buy a property at auction with no money like I did.
it's a pretty good story, Richard, I have to say, and good on you for taking the risk. And as you said, the risk, it looks from outside a risk, but if you do put in the right clause and understand the area well, which is your knowledge part, you can always mitigate those risks. So hats off to you on pulling that off. And it's good that you have set yourself on this path of doing the developments, and it's working out well for you. And as said, we will love to have you on the show back again to discuss the rest of your journey of other development projects that you've done. And please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let the word spread like a fire. Spark your fire. Cheers, Jazz and David.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.